You're listening to The Maker Podcast, a truly global portrait of the art of life. I'm on another level. This fire that I speak got me wrestling in doubt.
Adventures in time and space, told in future tense. Dimension X. Can you predict what will come in 100 years, or in 10, or in the next minute? Some people think they can. Nuclear scientists, mathematicians, astronomers, biologists. They'll predict the shape of the future. Why? Because they make the future. Because they see beyond the known dimensions of time and space, into the unknown. Dimension X.
For those of you who have not heard this, this is going to be an introduction to the work of Ashley Backus-Clark, and Ashley's going to tell us what she's doing in Amsterdam.
I'm here for the Netherlands Film Festival. I'm actually staying in Utrecht. So I arrived yesterday, and I will be doing a workshop on miraculous futures there, where my partner, Classine, who's also an interactive artist and designer, we will be doing speculative storytelling through using sort of tarot-inspired cards. So we made these really cool cards and had them illustrated, and we will be breaking up our teams into different groups, and they will pull a card just like you would in, you know, getting a tarot reading. But instead of it being a tool for examining your own life, you will use it as a tool to think about future worlds and how different themes interact to create a society.
Okay, so all of that sounds like fascinating, but it also sounds like, what are we talking about? So imagine if someone's diving into this podcast, they haven't heard part one, they don't know what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us exactly what you do. That's what you're going to do, but what does it mean to us?
So I'm a scientist and writer and storyteller, and I think a lot about futurism, particularly how we can create more inclusive futures and thinking about how everyone and their experiences have a place in this future. So I work across different mediums, the most recent being virtual reality. And in some of the work that I do, I'm thinking a lot about the intersection of spirituality and identity, particularly of people across the African diaspora, and really trying to make a broader claim about our contributions in future and technology and the way that we move through the world.
Okay. So again, just to back up a little bit, then we'll dive into that intersection that you talked about with spirituality and identity. That sounds fascinating. But can we back up and tell everyone how you got started in all of this?
Sure. So I studied science. I studied molecular biology. And when I was in school, I was really interested in art history as well. So I started taking a lot of classes and thinking about how art is more of a mode of telling the history of peoples and the history of societies, more so than, you know, what I was doing in science, just researching all day long. So that became a focus of mine. And I came to Europe after I graduated and got really into the art scene in Berlin and, you know, really wanted to be a part of that world, but also wanted to figure out how to integrate my background in science into it. So fast forward a few years, I read an article about virtual reality, and around this time I was getting more interested in neuroscience. And that was an eye-opening experience for me of thinking about this new technology and how it really has an impact on the way that we view reality. And I wanted to figure out how to put some of the interests that I was reading about neuroscience and translate it into thinking about storytelling through virtual reality, but tie in science as a theme in the story.
Okay.
So I partnered with two of my really close friends who had an interaction design studio, Hyphen Labs, and we brainstormed a really cool Afrofuturist story about a neuroscientist who turns a hair salon into her brain lab, and she's, you know, doing really, really fascinating interventions with some of her clients.
Okay, so could we put on VR goggles and have that experience?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that still something that you're that's out there for us to access?
Yeah. So right now it's in a group show in Eindhoven at Moo Art Space. So it'll be up there. I'm not sure when it's ending. I think it ends later this month. Okay. And then.
So I can probably see it.
Yeah.
Saturday.
Yeah, you can see it on Saturday.
That's fantastic.
It's in a show called Computer Girls.
Okay.
And also it'll be in a show in Hamburg in November. The full installation. Now, if you have a Oculus headset, you can download it through the Oculus store and view it at home.
That's amazing, because that means anyone anywhere in the world can have access to this experience if you have an Oculus.
Right. Headset. Yeah, just download it. It's free.
That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And in terms of this, the spirituality and identity, that sort of crossroads, can you talk to me a little bit more about that?
Yeah. Well, I personally, I grew up in a really religious household, but never felt connected to the dogma of religion. But spirituality has always been something that fascinates me, and that I wanted to learn more about, especially how people are coming to a more spiritual realization in this very technologically advanced society that we're living in, and how spirituality can be translated into those technologies, or if they're completely devoid of spirituality. And so thinking about different spiritual practices like Buddhism or meditation or Ifa, you know, thinking about some of the indigenous African religions, and you know, divination, and how different types of energies connect to deities. So there's a lot of mythology in the piece that we did at Hyphen Labs, Neurospeculative Afrofeminism. So mm-hmm. there are deities, and we wanted to see how we could use some of the divination ideals in some of these ancient religions and tie them into this new story.
Wow. Okay.
And if they can hold the same power as, you know, the deities that people pray to in real life.
Right, right. And so far, how many years have you been working with that particular installation?
About 3 years now.
Okay. And what's the feedback you're getting?
The feedback is that, you know, people are coming to this story because they haven't seen anything like it in VR, especially centering Black women. And it feels good to know that we're part of the conversation of getting more Black and brown, you know, women into this space and seeing themselves in it. So it's been really positive in that aspect. But also, you know, we're a multicultural team. And so we think a lot about what our responsibilities are as global citizens to speak on the behalf of people who aren't seen, and who have to fight to be seen and for their stories to be heard. And we feel like it's all of our responsibility to make sure that we all have an equal platform.
Yeah. So in terms of your own experience before you went out there and made this experience for the rest of the world, would you mind sharing a little bit of that with me?
Well, just being in science and being someone who's really creative and, like, you know, likes fashion and art and all these things, I wasn't really represented, on top of, you know, being a Black woman who is in, you know, some of these harder sciences. And so it was like in the art community where I found, like, I found my people, you know, but I also didn't feel like I couldn't be in science. But I left. And so my goal is to get people to understand that they can build community in different ways but still stay their course.
Okay.
And find empowerment through technology.
Yeah.
Because we use technology for everything else. And so if it means that, you know, in order to stay in this thing where you're constantly having to prove that you belong there, if you find community in other spaces, then maybe that will give you more strength or recourse to stay and complete what you're doing.
I understand. So for you, did you actually quit your course of study?
No, I finished. Okay. I finished. I just am not in directly in research science right now.
Okay, so you sort of made your own space kind of on the margins with your own community to turn it in. You made a world, kind of a virtual world for yourself, but you made it real.
Yeah. Right? It's kind of interesting to think about that now. Yeah.
Right.
It's like I wanted to, it's funny because I applied to a neuroscience program in Berlin thinking that I wanted to study neuroscience there. Right. And I didn't get into the program, but then now I'm ending up, kind of coming in through the back door where I'm still able to talk about neuroscience in a way that really interests me. And now, I've been in conversations with many universities talking about a topic that I wanted to study more in depth. So
nice. So that's inspiring for people.
Yeah.
Not just for STEM, but I mean, in general, just staying the course until you find your right people, as they say. Right?
And you can really build your own space within these institutions if you want to.
You have to be strong about it and stay focused.
And you have to have a community. You know, I don't think we talk enough about having a supportive system around artists. We typically tend to look at an artist and not see all of the work and the people behind the scenes that have helped them get to where they are. But I've really had such a strong community of support, which is how I am where I am.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, no matter what we're trying to get done, but I do think in terms of being a creative, some people think it's easy.
Oh, man.
Right? Because it's beautiful,
it is.
Aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah.
So it must be easy, right?
But and we glamorize the lifestyle of creatives. But it is. It's hard work. And, there may be months where you aren't bringing in an income or where you can't find client work or, you're working on a project that takes all of your time and you're up, all day and all night trying to finish it.
Yeah.
And so, that sacrifice, ultimately, if you love what you're doing, it's worth it. But it's there's always going to be trade-offs.
Yeah, and you're not getting paid while you're staying up till 4 o'clock in the morning, usually, right? You just have to believe in it.
Yeah, you have to believe in it. Yeah.
100%. So in terms of what you see coming in your future, what do you want to do next? You must have a million ideas where you want to go with this.
I want to make a film out of NSAF and...
Okay.
Turn the characters into, people that want to have a life of their own, outside of the story, sort of like Star Wars, building a whole world that people can enter into and that has the staying power and that is relevant generation after generation.
Yeah, it has a whole sort of spin-offs and things that go with it.
Yeah.
Makes people talk. And
yeah.
You'll be drinking out of an SAF mug. And
Get it
going.
License that.
That sounds very, very good. I can see the potentiality for this in education going really far.
Absolutely.
But starting early.
Yeah.
Have you thought about taking it to younger people?
Yeah.
Schools?
We've had workshops where we show it to high school students and, get them to start thinking about not just world building in a sense of, creation as a platform, but also creating themselves and empowering themselves. And we want to continue doing that. I'm also interested in, older popular, our elders, because we tend to put them away into a home, when they get a certain age, and there's so much knowledge there. And I think this story is really relevant for, people who are in, their twilight years and thinking about what contributions they have for us as a society and as humanity.
I like that. So it's a cross-generational contribution that you're thinking about. And you're sort of incorporating all of the bits of knowledge from all the different levels into one universe.
Yeah, so it's a cross-generational story. We have, a teenager. We have a woman who is, in her 40s. And then we have someone who's in their 70s. So it's really kind of spanning this generation.
That's really cool because then you can also get into their mindset, I would imagine, in this game.
Yeah.
Right? You can become these people.
Yeah.
Which I think will lead to a better understanding of just age, for example.
Right.
Not just gender, not just you know, skin color. You could go a lot of different ways.
And mortality, because then we have these deities who we, you know, we haven't said this, but they're kind of these characters, but in a different plane of existence, and then they become infinite.
I can't wait to see this. Yeah. But it's more like I can't wait to experience it, because you can see all these things. If you put on the goggles, all these things are going on.
Right, and we've built out the physical hair salon, so you're primed to feel like you're immersed in the story when you first, you know, step into the installation.
Why did you choose a hair salon?
Just because, you know, historically in the Black community, that's been a space of political activation and, you know, learning new things and connecting community and sharing and exchange. And we wanted to take those themes and, you know, tie them into what futurism and building the future through technology would look like.
Okay.
And it also makes the story approachable.
Yes, because it's almost like a grocery store.
Yeah.
It's like
a familiar space where you walk in there and you're like, okay, this feels familiar, but then, you know, you have to suspend disbelief because when you go in there, you were confronted with something that's not
right.
What you would see in reality.
I love that. It's almost like being on Tatooine or like some other planet and you walk into a bar and it kind of looks like a bar, but it's not really a bar.
Right.
I love that. I cannot wait to see this. The idea of it being a hair salon is super clever. I was with Coco, the friend that we're at her apartment right now.
Uh-huh.
We went to see the opening of a film called Black Girl Church about 2 weeks ago.
Oh, wow.
And it's from a filmmaker who now lives in Harlem, actually. She's from Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
Marissa Pinot, I think her last name is. And it takes place in a hair supply store.
Ooh.
So the content is about women and how they gather in these hair supply stores, and it's exactly what you just said.
Yeah,
it's this comfortable space where you can be yourself and connect with other people who are like you and understand you, and so your guard is kind of down, right, and then you can have a completely different experience. But it's not a fantasy, it's just like real life.
Yeah,
so all this makes
sense. I'd like
sense
to see
to
that.
I'm going to make sure that you do.
Yeah, that sounds really cool.
There's a lot of stuff going on out there, which kind of makes me think this too. I think you are at a really good time for doing what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I think now people are maybe more open to it. I don't know, how many years have you been trying to open this door?
Well, just as far as the piece we made, it's been 3 years. But before that, I think this story has been...
The story's been cooking
for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, my colleagues, Carmen and Ej, and I talk about this all the time, about like how this story has been built over the course of our friendship
and
knowing each other and some of these themes we've been talking about and thinking about. But 2016 really was like a pivotal time as far as the music we were listening to, what was happening politically in the States, and, you know, just the place at which virtual reality found itself then.
Yeah.
So we had an opportunity.
So how did what was going on in the States affect the story that you're telling? Because that has to have an impact, if you don't mind talking about it.
I mean, the summer of 2016, there were like a number of killing of unarmed Black men. And we were both working in very different spaces right now and didn't feel like we had a space to talk about or process what was going on.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to create something that was empowering for, you know, people who could see themselves in a space that wasn't just centered around death and, you know, like trying to fight for existence or existing in the way that we wanted to be represented. And so we poured some of that grief and some of those questions into making something that people could go into and feel a sense of hope. And things have not changed that much, but it does feel like there are more opportunities to see us in spaces where we wouldn't have necessarily seen ourselves before.
So your piece was a part of a healing process.
For ourselves, yeah.
For sure. Like a conscious part of it? Did you know you were doing it when you were doing it?
No, we just knew that we were having an amazing time, like building something. So
yeah. It just sort of came from a heartfelt space, but also like a place of urgency, I would think.
Right. And now thinking back to that time, it's like, wow, will we ever feel like that again? Just like the pure joy of creating something without expectation.
Yeah. Yeah. So you made this world so that people could step into it and see a different, more beautiful, stronger version of themselves, just being unquestionably loved.
Right.
And
right.
existing in the universe, but in a holistic way.
Yeah. And giving people who haven't had that experience a sort of bird's eye view into it without feeling like they had to be represented in the story, you know?
What do you mean by that?
So when you go into the experience, you're actually embodied in one of the characters, and you okay. become this young Black woman, okay. and you go through the story in her body. And so really you... not only take on her identity or her role in the story, but you really have to kind of remove yourself from it. And so in VR, kind of when you're in someone else's body and yeah. you have agency over that body, like you're able to become more immersed in the story. And we wanted to play with some of those situations.
Yeah, I can see that. I understand what you mean. So it's sort of like a trying to make sense of this. So you, when you're watching a film, for example, you're just imagining that you're that person.
Yeah, and you're right? coming at it from more of a third-person
exactly.
perspective.
Exactly, and you're outside of the entire experience.
Right.
And this is like walking into a film.
Yeah.
And I would assume that people have more emotional responses to it, I think.
Yeah.
yeah?
Especially if something is like in your face or it startles you or something like that.
Yeah.
You're like, wow, the entire world is around me in 360 degrees. So,
right.
which, you know, when you're watching on a screen or in 2D, you know, you can be really moved by something and impacted by it. But
right.
like being in there in the moment is something much different.
Right. It's just like if we walk out onto the street right now in Amsterdam, it is what it is. And it's there and you can
yeah.
touch it and feel it. Except you can't really touch it and feel it, but you feel like you can.
Right. But being here now, like, you're in it. But
right.
if you're just looking at Amsterdam on Google Maps or something, and,
right.
like, scrolling through the canals, that's much,
right.
that's a different story.
That's a different story.
Yeah.
I love the idea of getting people out of their universes into this third universe. I think
right.
it is a good healing tool. I kind of feel that it could, I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but I really do think it can help bridge gaps. I want to believe that.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of people who are using VR for PTSD and, like, for alternating healing methods, you know, getting you into meditative states or trying to see what removing you from your environment and putting you in a different environment, even if it's virtual, what
yeah.
that can do for, you know, the way that your brain processes, you know, where your physical body is.
Yeah. And what are the results so far of that kind of work that you could speak on? Is it...
I haven't really looked at any of the most recent studies, but I think there has been some, like, really significant results for people who are experiencing PTSD. And it's being recognized as a, you know, something that can be used in addition to other therapies.
Yeah.
In order to, you know, look at how to treat these things. Much in the same way as, like, psychedelics are now becoming something that people are looking into as alternating healing methods.
Yeah.
So,
I think you're trying to come at it from all different angles.
Yeah.
There's so much trauma
exactly.
out there in various forms. And, well, you're in Amsterdam right now, but you just left California.
Yes.
And we know what the weed story is in California. We know
yes,
what it is.
Yes, we do.
In
There's
Amsterdam.
So many different things. My partner actually just went to like a women in cannabis festival
yeah.
and like, you know, where different new entrepreneurial endeavors are, you know, being introduced to the public. And there's so many different ways people are thinking about cannabis now that's so innovative, which you couldn't do that when it was illegal.
Right.
Or like, so it's fascinating to see how people innovate.
Yes,
when they have access.
Exactly, that's the thing. It seems not related. Like, okay, so obviously they're in Amsterdam, they don't talk about weed. It's not that. I never talk about this on the podcast. The reason I'm talking to you about it is because you're interested in the human brain.
Yeah.
And how it works.
Right.
And you're interested in how people move through space and what makes them do what they do and the stories they tell. And that requires agency and license.
Yeah.
Right? And you need all the different healing modalities humanly possible, and sometimes they're on lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
You can't access them.
Or just if you're working in a space where people are afraid to experiment, then you have to try to find that somewhere else.
Yes.
And luckily we live in a time where a lot of artists are starting to experiment in science, and there's like a lot of, you know, different laboratories and citizen science places where you can go and do experiments that like
right.
really look like the labs that I was working in grad school. And it's cool to see that, because then when you have those spaces, you can think about things in a way that scientists or people who are very immersed in like the mechanisms or techniques of doing something, yeah. who are like experts in their field, yeah. would tell you why 1,000 times why that's not going to work.
Right.
But these kind of cross partnerships between people who are in different fields,
yeah.
produce some incredible results sometimes, because it's like someone in your blinds, like thinking through a blind spot that you might have. And
right. I like the idea of what I'm going to call it, like cross-pollination, because it seems like when you're doing science, you have to use the scientific method, or else, you know, you're just not really a scientist, I suppose.
Right.
But if you are Ashley and you come at it from this artistic background, do you get a lot of sort of pushback from that? Because that seems super unscientific. You know, on the surface.
Sometimes I think because I have had that scientific, like, rigorous training, sometimes right. I can like talk my way out of it or right. through it. But right. yeah, there, I mean, we've been in the room with a lot of scientists who are like, you know, what is this? But yeah. then, you know, because you have the language to talk to them about something that may pertain to their research, or, you know, we can speak a common language, then that brings a barrier down. And having people in the room that can translate, you yes. know, within that cross-pollination yes. is really important, because it does serve to put, you know, tear down some of those walls, so that people who think they're speaking two different languages can talk to each other.
Yes. And for, in terms of the people who can translate that, how would you describe their title? Because you're opening a door to maybe a new field of study for yeah. young people.
Right? I mean, I think it's called like interdisciplinary
okay.
study.
Okay.
Just, you know, from my experience, I think that's what that kind of interdisciplinary study is supposed to be. I don't think that it works right in a lot of ways.
That's why I said, what would you call it?
Right. What I would call it, you know, when I joined the team at Hyphen Labs, I gave myself the title of speculative neuroscientist. And that's
like
just
you
because,
it.
Yeah,
it.
You have to invent some right. terms if you don't have a term for it already.
Right.
And to me, that embodied someone who has that scientific background, but who's also open to different ways of storytelling within science. Because, you know, to have a cohesive picture of everything, even if you're doing research or you're building a project or you're an engineer or an architect or something like that, there has to be a through line to
yeah.
that story.
Yeah.
And so
exactly. It's not, you know, just random and wild universe. It has to be sort of orchestrated.
Right. Yeah.
And I think what you're fighting against, and I think it's brave of you, but I can just feel like the energy from you, that you don't think of it as brave. You just, it's just what you need to do. It's who you are. Like, you probably couldn't get through life any other way without asking these questions.
I think it's brave because there's no precedent for it. You know, every day I'm like, what am I going to do? You know, like, how am I going to get from here to where I want to be?
Yeah.
But ultimately, things fall in place. And, you know, when you're talking about something that hasn't been talked about before, even if people think you're completely out of left field,
right.
they still want to engage with some of those ideas.
Right.
And that's been really interesting and inspiring, and it's gotten us into a lot of places that have helped us get
yeah.
to, you know, maybe it's like a commercial job that we've done, or
right.
a residency, or, you know, a collaborator. But
yeah. It's just that curiosity.
Yeah,
like,
that
she
curiosity.
Might be kooky, but let me see what's up.
Let's see what we can find here.
Right,
yeah.
exactly.
And I'm the same way. You know, sometimes I'm like really drawn to people who are talking about something that I've never heard of before,
right.
or, you know, who are coming out of left field. You're like, where is this person
right.
coming at this
right.
idea from? Because it's fascinating. It's like,
yeah.
you know, you've gone through this, the same society, the same sort of rules and regulations and restrictions as this person over here. And yet, you know, you're able to think about things and build things in a way that, you know, not a lot of people think about. So
exactly. So it's a gift when people can see things differently, because there's so much noise out there. And
yeah.
now, I mean, I don't have to tell you this, but I think about it all the time, because there's so much noise out there in general, but the technology magnifies the noise.
Yeah.
So you can hear everyone else's voice from wall to wall in the entire planet. And inside of that, you have to formulate your own ideas.
Yeah.
And make them palatable to these people who think, well, you're not really doing science and you're also not an artist. So you're blazing your own trail with all this noise at the same time.
Yeah, and then it can be overload, you know? There's so much information out there now that how do you connect with people who are going to support you through that vision?
Exactly, exactly. And you know, this is like a generic kind of a question, but I always want to ask as many important, smart, clear-thinking technologists as I possibly can, so I'm going to ask you as well. In terms of the impact that technology is having on young people, I'm always concerned about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm particularly thinking about girls and body image and all that kind of stuff. And I'm thinking also for men now, the question of masculinity and all these ideas that come from the internet, I see these things changing the culture.
Yeah.
And I'm saying that as an educator, I can see the people are different now.
Mm.
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
So what could you tell me about what you think is going on there and how we can assist? Because it's not going away.
Right. It's not going away. And I think anything in excess comes with consequences. And for me, I don't know if the people who created these apps had an idea of what they were doing when they created them. But as time went on, then yes, you know, you build in these things to make, you know, the apps on your phone more addictive. And year over year, it gets more and more addictive. We know what's going on and we know now what the long-term consequences are, but we've reached a critical point where you can't really backtrack. And so now, you know, there's an app to regulate your apps or, you know, we have problems with privacy on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, and these technologies are interfering in our elections. All of these things where we see that the cost far outweighs the benefit. Yeah. And so I think it comes down to having an education of technology. I think it needs to start in elementary school. You know, we need to start teaching students about what their online profiles are and how they have real world implications. You know, what you do online doesn't just stay online. It follows you out into the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really have siblings or, but I have nieces and nephews who are like teenagers, and the things that they can do online, it's like, whoa, you know, like that's so much different than it was when I was in high school.
Right.
And our parents, my mom, their grandmother, my sister, they don't have the tools to really understand what this technology is doing. And so it's kind of like kids are educating themselves or being educated by their peers.
Yeah.
And I think that ethical framework really needs to be built into education.
Yeah. That's one of the best answers I've heard in a long time. I think about this a lot because, again, as I said, I'm an educator. I'm around a lot of young people. I do have children of my own, so I have access and, you know, mental access to all these other young people, and I'm looking at them, and I see their image of themselves changing, if you will.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is, for me, the ethics question comes in, and I know that Facebook has sort of put some things out there and stepped up to the plate and said, we know that this is addictive, and we know that when you click on Instagram, we're going to feed you two of these little pictures, and then we're going to like you in an hour and a half and make you come back and get more.
Hmm.
That doesn't seem like good ethics to me.
No.
Like, why would you do that?
Yeah, I mean,
you know, it's worse than candy. People used to be like, yeah, well, it's like candy or television. Well, that wasn't great either.
But it didn't impact people in the same way.
Exactly.
You know, like, whereas literally it's inserting itself into every piece of your life. Yes. Like I just downloaded this app called Moment, and it shows me every time I pick up my phone, how long I've been on my phone, what I'm interacting with. And when you really sit there and look at, like, wow, I've been on my phone for 4 hours today.
Yeah.
That's so much time.
It is.
To passively, in most cases, just be checking an app to see if, you know, someone liked something.
Exactly. Exactly. And that whole scenario of, you know, the verb of liking something, just, it's a little tiny thing.
Yeah.
But I think it's shifted people. I really do. Especially young people, because all of us want to be accepted and loved and in a tribe of some sort.
Right.
But the idea of giving a thumbs up or a thumbs down and it changes someone's entire life is a video game. mindset.
Oh, yeah. Right? This gamification
of your life,
social interactions.
Exactly. I don't know how great that is.
I don't know how great it is, too, but I think nothing is entirely good.
Right.
Or entirely bad.
Right. So I think to go back to what you said, it's that education about technology that needs to start very early because, you know, you and I can see five-year-olds. When you can read, you can have an iPad. I've seen that. We've all seen that. But the question is, what's it doing to them and what are they doing with it?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It's, I really think that the youth, like not even Gen Y, but like the kids who are coming up now who are born literally with like a phone or an iPad attached to them. Like I was on my flight from LA, there was this little baby sitting in the row kind of ahead of me. She must have been like not even one or something, but she like kept reaching for her dad's phone and she was just like, you know, she knew exactly what to do. And I'm like, this baby can like barely keep their head up by themselves and they know, you know, how to be on a phone. And we're a completely different species than, you know, people who were born in the 90s or something like that, who like their brains developed up to a point without having technology interfering with it.
Yeah. These are those questions that I want to ask you because I know that if you're entering with your artistic background into the world of science, you've had people look at you strangely. This is your opportunity to look at me strangely because I have these questions and I just have to ask you this. So in terms of the technology and how it's going to change our biology, I have concerns about that because when you're walking around in certain cities are more intense than others, people are looking down constantly. Yeah. So they're not looking at you, but I'm thinking about their spinal columns and their neck, and are we going to have children who are just born like with a bent spinal column, just ready to look at that
or
device?
Or that have like tunnel vision.
Exactly. And I don't know if it's changing the brain, you know?
There's been some, I can't remember what this artist's name is, but she made these wax babies that are like modified babies, like morphed into like what technology is doing for us or like what babies are going to look like in order to like deal with some of the environmental changes that are going on.
Yeah.
And it's really fascinating to think about like how accelerated evolution can be in terms of, you know, historically it's taken millennia for the slightest changes to humanity to happen.
Right.
But now, you know, that evolution is accelerated because of, you know, artificial interventions that we're creating.
Yeah,
not
it's
just
exponential.
From, like, our environment, but, yeah.
Yeah, that's my concern.
I don't have the answer to that. But it is something that I think about.
It's a good question, though, right?
But sometimes, for me, it becomes a little bit dystopic when I think that, if we change the framework of how we think about it and, like, instead of, like, catastrophizing, figuring out how we can use it to our advantage, like, part of me thinks that people are waking up. It might be, I don't know if it's too late or not, but, you know, I do think that people are, like, trying to become more mindful, and they're like, whoa, you know, what am I doing? What are my kids doing? Are we even going to have a planet to live on?
Right.
And, you know, just the fact that people are starting to ask some of these questions give me hope.
Yes.
And I just hope we can continue down a path of, you know, like really waking up, because it can be scary.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't want to be, you know, tragic about the whole thing. It's just a curiosity that I have, because, you know, it's impacting us. I know it's impacting me.
Yeah.
And I've never seen a child as young as the one that you saw on the airplane, but that's concerning, because you have to think, you know more about the human brain than I do, but we both know you have no frontal lobe for many, 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 many decades. Like, you're 25, and you get that decision-making center going on, good for you. But what happens in between when you're feeding it all this crazy data from the entire universe?
Yeah, I mean, your synapses, your neural networks are being pruned and formed in a way that is mirroring your universe or in your environment, too.
Yeah.
So, like, it really matters what you do consistently, like what you form habits on, because the habits that you form, that becomes, you know, a pathway in your brain, and you just continue to do it. So, you know, when I'm picking up my phone, I've trained myself to do it, and it's a habit. I'm not even conscious of it.
Yeah.
And so, like, when you have young kids doing stuff like that, then, you know, like, how is your attention going to be in the future? How will you be able to perform you know, at a job, if you have to hyper focus or you have to do deep work on something, can you do that?
Yeah. It's like, I think a domino effect, but I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, if we change one thing, like the way we look at the world, like what you just said, then we have to change the work environment to adapt to it.
Yeah, we do. And that takes, changing the way we think about work and age. Something that I think is really interesting is I've seen like so many young entrepreneurs who are like in high school building companies on their iPad or on their phone or something. Like, that's really cool. That's inspiring.
That is cool. That is inspiring.
Think about, like, you know, when I was in high school, I was like at the mall trying to get a job. But like, I am on YouTube and I see these kids like putting out really amazing content where they're not just thinking about, you know, video games or something. They're really thinking about, like, how can I become financially independent by the time I'm 25? And, like, I'm going to make a video about this and, like, show you how to use your computer. Like, that's what I'm talking about. Of, like, okay, if you're on your phone all day long because you're building a business, that's much different than, like, you being on Snapchat or, like, TikTok or whatever.
Exactly, you know? Exactly. It's a completely different way of using the tool.
Yeah.
And I think mostly that we're in it and it's not going anywhere. So I think that it's mostly positive if you're awake about what you're doing.
Yeah.
And you're educating yourself about what this thing is doing with you, to you, for you. You have to ask yourself questions.
Or if you're building the framework. Because I think that's what it is. It's like, if you're going to... You have this kind of like unharnessed power and potential on your phone. And if you really want to optimize the way you use it to build in systems within it. So, like, if you know that you shouldn't be on the internet, like, going on a website, you put a block on it. Or you know, make sure that you don't have games downloaded on your phone so that you're not tempted to play them. Or, you know, something like this. Like, you really have to... And it's kind of like, you know, controlling your living space, too. Like, you want to make sure that you have restrictions around things that you know that aren't, you know, serving you.
Right.
And then I think that it becomes easier to build beneficial habits when you're, you know, creating that kind of friction.
Yeah. It's about, like, discipline.
Yeah.
Really not having a pile of chocolate if you're not wanting to dig into chocolate.
Yeah, like putting that chocolate in away or throwing away or something.
Don't buy it in the first place. Which is the equivalent of don't have the app on your phone.
Right.
Make it more difficult for yourself to dig into that. Right. Yeah. And one of the things that I think is, I think it's hopeful and very positive about what you're doing is you're thinking as you build these algorithms and you go into these systems, because I was talking with another friend about this before. These machines are just machines. We're the one making them feel and look and sense and act like us.
Right.
So you have to be careful about what you put in there, because garbage in, garbage out. Right? Yeah. And whatever you put in there is going to come out into the universe.
Yeah, and we haven't even like gotten to thinking about artificial intelligence or AI, or like how human bias are being built into these systems, and what, you know, how that is impacting the world that we live in too. And so, yeah, it's like, if you're putting a garbage algorithm out there, you know, that's going to have long-term effects for people, you know, who are engaging with what you've built.
Exactly. And so that is that was one of the questions I had for you in terms of where this goes in terms of helping people to understand each other and bridge the gap. If you put that same data in, it's like a bad history book and you just put it online and digitized it, but the content is still the same. So do you have any sort of ideas of how we can make that different in terms of who builds the algorithms? How do you change that narrative?
Well, I mean, I think, again, it goes back to, like, education, the curriculum, because I think that we are at a place where it's, like, you're under such a time pressure to do things that you don't even think critically about what you're doing most of the time. You know, you don't think about, like, whoa, if I think this way and, you know, I'm writing code in this frame of mind, like, that then becomes an extension of my beliefs. Or, you know, like, I don't think a lot of people have the capacity to think about that. And I don't think that we're taught how to think critically in our, and I'm speaking, you know, from a very US centric mode, because that's where I was educated, but like, we're not thinking about philosophy or ethics, and how that ties into everything that we do, especially in STEM. You know, I think like when you have humanities class courses or thinking, you know, you are exposed to a little bit more, but like, that's just now becoming a part of the curriculum at some of these big universities in the sciences.
Okay, so in terms of the education, what we're going to call formalized education is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
The basis needs to go back old school, like all the things about Platonic and Socrates and the Greeks and all the things from Africa and all the things
right.
from Asia. All of that thinking in there, which would be higher order thinking, if is one way of
it
calling
is,
it.
Yeah.
And we call it critical thinking and logic. All those things are kind of gone. Mm-hmm. And being taken out of a lot of the school systems, and art also,
yeah,
believe it or not.
It's like underfunding and then, you know, completely disappears.
Yeah. And then you end up in a situation where you have everything in a silo, and then here comes Ashley to bring it back together and reconnecting the universe to itself. That's really what it is.
It is. It's like we have to get back to that kind of higher order thinking because the interweb and like complication of all of these issues that we're facing right now, like we're going to have to be able to think our way out of it. I don't really know how we do that, especially as it seems like all of our governments are imploding on themselves and, you know, there's more hostility globally. Like, how do we turn our attention towards some of the critical problems that we're facing as a, you know, like as a civilization? You know, like we're really staring down the doomsday clock as far as, you know, environmental, like climate change issues. Like, I think all of our brains need to be on that issue, not, you know, over here thinking about what our governments are doing.
You know, one of the things that is inspiring to me, and it's amazing that you just said that, like, how do we do this? We need to focus our attention. What do we do? You're already doing it. That's why I love having this conversation with you, because I want other people to know you're out there doing it.
And
you're
to
out
come there. Join me.
Exactly.
Yeah,
come join Ashley. Help her get it done. And it's, I think that it's all kinds of different voices and all kinds of different levels of education, and answers can come from anywhere. And we need all the creativity we can get. And I think for me, one solution is pick an issue that you're passionate about and do something about it. Just one. Mm. You don't have to know about everything.
Mm-hmm.
But just pick one thing and then do something about it, and you will find your right people.
Yeah.
That's one kind of a solution, you know? Because I think sitting back and talking about it, like, oh, what are we going to do? That's when I feel like, this is not great.
Just kind of like
not talking about it,
intellectualizing.
Yeah. That ain't great for me.
And I tend to see that, like, you know, we go to conferences and, you know, do all of this stuff. And I'm like, I think that's great. And I think it's like bringing people together. But like, I want to go to a conference where we get out there and build something together to like do something to make a change.
Yes. Like what you've built.
Yeah,
already,
let's
your
do
experience,
that, like,
which
on
I'm
a
going
mass
to see
scale.
Saturday.
Yeah.
Right? Is there anything else that you want to tell us before we go? I feel like I'm going to come up with 10 other questions and I'll be interviewing you again Saturday. It'll be like Ashley part 3.
I'm thinking a lot about forgetting right now.
What does that mean? What do you mean?
So, just thinking about, you know, dementia and like how our brains are kind of oversaturated and overstimulated, what does forgetting look like? And, you know, how does that become more complicated with our access to technology? So that's kind of a new project that I've been thinking about, of, you know, like, how can our environment and our technology capture our memories far after our brains have lost the ability to hold and capture them?
It's amazing, because you just kind of brought yourself back full circle, and me too, in this whole conversation, because you're talking about critical thinking, you're talking about technology, but how does it connect with ethics and humanitarian thought, but also the humanities? And you're talking about forgetting.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking, okay, so here's Socrates, and he goes like, I don't know if people should be reading books, because they might not remember stuff. And that sounds crazy now, right? And then people were like, I don't know about this printing press thing. It's probably got the devil in it. It's kind of weird that the ink's staying on the page and all of that. So each technology brings that with it.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole concept was, how much can these people remember? that was what his concern was. Are we going to forget our history because we're writing everything down?
Right.
And then what happens? Then what are you going to do with your brain? Your concern is it's so overstuffed.
Yeah.
How does that balance
out?
Yeah,
how do you access the information that's in there?
Yeah.
And does that anxiety of not being able to access this information, can that work in the same way as someone who, you know, has Alzheimer's or something like that? Like, does it become this kind of like spiral or this loop?
Do you think that there could be some kind of not a cure, but something that could help people with Alzheimer's in this technology that's out there?
Man, I was reading this article about this woman who cured a lot of the symptoms of her dementia and Alzheimer's through diet. And I'm thinking a lot about diet too, just as someone who has an autoimmune condition of, you know, we have all of these medications and technologies now, but can something as simple as food technology like cure us of chronic inflammation and things like that, which impact our brain? So, and now our food sources as potent as they once were because of what we've done to the soil on the planet. So like, is that going to become a commodity that only wealthy people or people of a certain class have access to? It's like food as medicine.
Now you've done it again. Like now you're doing Hippocrates, right? Like let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food, right? But no one remembers that part. They just remember the part of do no harm.
Do no harm, yeah.
Which is cool. I'm with that. Yeah. Do no harm. But also let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food. That is super dope, right? Yeah.
It is.
Incredibly important. And look where we are now.
Yeah, I think all aspects of wellness, you know, have to factor into our experiences.
Exactly. It has to be holistic, and it's sort of a strange situation. It's not by mistake, it's by design that we don't see those dots as being connected, the whole mind, body, spirit. They've never been disconnected. We just talk about them as if they are.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
So, Ashley Backus Clark, I want to call you a speculative neuroscientist, but I think scientist, writer, storyteller, all of that works. Does all of that work?
All of that works.
All of that works for you.
Just trying to figure it out.
I love it. Yeah. So since we're still human, I'm going to take you to eat real food now.
Ooh, that sounds amazing.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us on the Maker Podcast here in Amsterdam.
Thank you for having me in beautiful Amsterdam.
Thank you so much.
Cool.
ETA got me paid now, and I'm at my maximum potential. No more minimum wage now, my whole flow a grenade now. Every bar that I spit cut sharp like a blade now. Lost bras give me play now, full of thirst. I don't hit them, I just surf from the wave now. I've been working like a slave now. My partners catching plays because they tired of looking for a way out. My mama see me on the stage now, a long way from the days when I laid on that bass cat. I get high, I'll play that. Told my homies who know me, we about to be global. From the hood, but can't stay out. I keep OGs with me half the time like T-Mobile. I ain't really hella social. My supporters, they know how I move cause they follow. Turn my circle to an O. Cause some boys like four quarters, they change for $1. Holler. Young black and a scholar. Probably could've went to Oxford. They tryna kick it like soccer. My mama still tryna get me to be a doctor. I told her, hey, I'm on another level. My mama, her neck and fingers finna be freezing.
For sure.
Cause I go off the deep end for all them nights she was weeping.
Huh.
All them tears she was leaking.
Uh-huh.
Days that we wasn't speaking straight up. Tell a hater to get his weight up.
Yeah.
Oh, cool the noble pass, but before he left, got me prayed
yes,
up.
Sir.
That's probably why I stayed up. Caught the rhythm and catered. My papa told me do right and angels gon' celebrate us. Look,
I be crashing the mic, but I do it for all of my dogs.
Whoa.
Whoa. I remember when we stayed in Winfield and washing my drawers.
Oh.
The OG J Slim did a bit cause he clapped at the laws.
True. But from where I'm from, we hear claps like it's round of applause. Oh, bars 3D like the Dudleys. I keep it real.
For sure.
My cousin say he bloody and keep the steel. I offended little buddy. I said, be for real. Tell me one gangster that you know live with his auntie still. Boy, you tripping on maps. Slap the blood out your mouth if you say big and back. Being bull one more time, you ain't trapping. You trapped every cage bird. Don't sing some of them just a death. Boy, God. I'm on another level. I'm on another level. This fire that I spit got me wrestling in the doubt. I'm on another level. I'm on another level. This fire that I spit got me wrestling in the doubt.